This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're going to pull apart some of the thickets of new information on global climate change and its impact on human life. A major international report released last week suggests that the global warming trend has already begun and some of its outcomes may be difficult or impossible to stop. This has consequences for life on each continent, not just environmentally, but economically and socially. The U.S. Supreme Court also weighed in on climate change last week, saying that CO2, or carbon dioxide, a major greenhouse gas, can be listed as a pollutant. This could prompt increased regulation at the federal level. Coming up on the program, we'll talk to a Yale economist who's studying the impact of climate change on rich and poor countries across the world, and we'll talk with a Wesleyan scientist who's calculating how much carbon dioxide levels are raising temperatures. We'll also try to find out what's being done internationally and at the state level. Tomorrow evening at 6:30 at Hartford's Mark Twain House, the World Affairs Council hosts Global Warming, a panel discussion, and we'll start our conversation there. Joining me by phone is Dr. Angie Seth, a research assistant professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Connecticut, part of this panel. Dr. Seth, thank you so much for joining us here on Where We Live.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Also joining me in studio, Chris James, manager of climate change and energy programs at the Department of Environmental Protection. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
The panel will be moderated by Congressman John Larson. He's the first district congressman in the state of Connecticut. Congressman Larson joins us for a few minutes as well. Congressman Larson, welcome back to Where We Live.
Great to be here, John.
Let me start with Chris James, who's here in studio with me, and get a little sense of, as we begin to have this conversation tomorrow at the World Affairs Council, what was the impact of this study that was released last week?
The UN study?
The UN study, specifically.
Well, it really reinforced a lot of the efforts that states like Connecticut have done over the past several years, which, as you may recall, those were based on the last UN report that was released back in 2001. The UN basically indicated that what we're seeing now is very likely to be human-induced global warming, and the rate of change is much more rapid than folks had even suggested occurring a few years ago. So it really enforces the economy-wide type of program that we're looking at here in Connecticut, where we're looking at, you know, all economic sectors, not just power plants, not just automobiles, but looking at the agricultural sector, what consumers can do, those type of things, I think will all be buttressed very much by that report that came out on Friday.
And we want to spend a lot of time looking at what exactly we can do starting now after several of these reports have come out. But Dr. Seth, I think that one of the remarkable things about the study suggests, maybe not for the first time, but it does suggest fairly strongly that some of these results, some of the things that have already started to happen, aren't necessarily going to be able to be reversed, even if we start doing everything we can right now. That seems one of the daunting parts of this study.
Yes, that's true. There are delays built into the system so that we haven't seen the full results of the warming that are due just based on how much carbon dioxide is already in the atmosphere. And so the warming will continue just based on what's there now, and the impacts of that warming will continue through 2050. So even if we cut everything, our use of fossil fuels immediately, we would still see some warming. But, you know, that's the bad news. The good news is that the actions that we take now will have or can have dramatic impacts in the extent of the warming later in the century. So we're committed to some warming, but the question really we're faced with is how much warming are we going to permit? And we do have a lot to say about that.
Do you think, Dr. Seth, that this ups the ante in any way, though, as far as how much needs to be done starting right now, that perhaps what we could be doing to stop the warming trend needs to be, I suppose, increased over the course of the next couple of years beyond what we had previously thought?
Well, it's true that because of the delays in the system, we do have to ramp up our efforts over time. And there are some strategies that have been proposed, this wedge concept where if we use existing technologies and build in new technologies as they become available, we can do what's needed. But the important thing to note is that the longer we wait to take action, the larger responses we will have to make later. So the sooner we get started, the better.
Congressman John Larson is going to be the moderator of this program that's happening tomorrow night at the Mark Twain House, the World Affairs Council hosting global warming, a panel discussion. Congressman Larson, tell me what you think the likely federal reaction to some of the things that we heard last week is going to be. First, of course, the United States Supreme Court ruling on CO2. Secondly, this UN panel report. What do you see happening in the next few months, perhaps, at the federal level and in Congress surrounding global climate change?
Well, John, Congress is already meeting extensively in the committee, John Dingell on the Commerce Committee, but as you're well aware of, Leader Pelosi, our speaker, has put together a select committee on global warming and energy, and I think the combination of the two will be the focus of the select committee, and then try to pull together all the very good pieces of legislation that are going on in the respective committees to make this the focus of the United States Congress, in stark contrast to the administration, who has pulled away from the Kyoto protocols and kind of gone it alone here and is in denial with respect to global warming. We truly believe that we're in a race between cooperation and catastrophe, and we really do need to start cooperating early on, and so therefore the importance of hearings and the importance of panels like we're going to have tomorrow evening at the Mark Twain House.
Chris James, I'm wondering if you can speak about some of the specifics, for instance, that Connecticut is doing, some of the ways in which we want to start combating this and maybe future solutions that have not yet been adapted either at the state or federal level that need to start coming into play, that need to start being talked about a little bit more.
Sure. And actually, the that wedge example is a very good one because it has the concept that there's a number of things we can do today that make economic sense that also provide environmental benefits and help us with our energy security situation as well. And I would first mention the efforts that we've done on energy efficiency, where currently Connecticut has, as people know, a program that's funded by ratepayers, and those funds are invested in a variety of measures to either reduce existing use, help reduce like in new buildings and construction, and you know, other types of upgrades that are done, whether the building is, you know, a new or an old building. Those make incredible amount of sense. We see a $4 payback for every $1 invested in energy efficiency, and they help avoid the need for us to run, like, the diesel generators in southwest Connecticut, which happen to also run at the same time that we have unhealthy air quality. So there are a whole host of benefits from actions we take today that also will help us long-term reduce our carbon footprint. And we see energy efficiency as huge in that area. There's a number of other things we can do. We have submitted a plan through the state's Energy Conservation Management Board, for example, that shows how we can flatten the demand of electricity growth in Connecticut solely through energy efficiency. And that makes incredible economic sense to us as well.
Dr. Angie Seth, the research professor at the Department of Geography at the University of Connecticut, is part of this panel as well. What do you say to this notion that so many states, of course, have taken on individually the task of trying to reduce the impact on global climate change? Each state has its own plan. Some states obviously working in concert with one another, filing suits against the federal government, et cetera. But essentially, many different governmental agencies are coming up with their own plan. At a certain point, doesn't there need to be a stronger nationwide example where one plan goes forward, all 50 states, and then perhaps leaking over into other countries?
Yes, I would agree with you. I'm not an expert on the policy issues, but what is needed are policies that will address some immediate incentives for getting started on the problem and having long-term goals that will actually reduce our carbon emissions substantially. The numbers being given are 70 to 80% by 2050. So there are some very significant changes that are needed. And because the states right now are implementing legislation and rules individually, my understanding, just from reading the newspapers and following the news, is that this actually makes it very difficult for many corporations to make the changes that are needed because it's being done in a piecemeal way. So there are a lot of industry and other groups that are actually asking for federal legislation so that there can be an even playing field for people to start really working this problem. And that will also help very much in the international negotiations as well. So we do have to have federal legislation.
And I'm wondering, Dr. Seth, before we let you go, if there's anything else that you plan to bring to the table to this panel discussion tomorrow evening, any other concerns or perhaps solutions that you've been thinking of?
Well, I'm a climate scientist, so I'm really more the bearer of bad news than good news. But the good news is that we can solve this problem. There's no question that we can solve it, and there are many, many opportunities for growth in doing so. So I am not an expert in those technologies, but I am trying to keep up on the different possibilities, and they definitely exist. So between myself and Chris James and John Larson, we should be able to provide some really positive reinforcement for the things that are possible.
Congressman Larson, it seems as though being the bearer of bad news has been part of the role of the climate scientist over the course of the last few years. We've been hearing bad news piled on top of bad news. How do you think that has an impact on the way people view this problem? There's this deluge of bad news every day that the world is warming and there's nothing that we can do about it. Doesn't that, it seems like it must affect the policy decisions that you make in Washington.
Well, I think there's been, there's a cultural effect, or some would argue an anthropological effect, among some who are in denial about global warming and say, as former Speaker Gingrich, that there's absolutely no evidence to support global warming whatsoever. Well, I think that can be pretty widely debunked. But the important thing here is to turn to the hope. And as I said before, we're in kind of a race here between catastrophe and cooperation. And I think here we need to cooperate. And we're presented with an opportunity where we get to address an issue in terms of the environment, climate change, in terms of the economy and what we can do in terms of our technological advancements into making the world more green. I'm a member of the Hydrogen Caucus. We're very bullish on fuel cells. And when you get an opportunity to talk about the environment, the economy, an energy source that also happens to be related to foreign policy, i.e., weaning us off of dependence upon foreign oil, then you have a dynamic that's shaping up here in the country and in the United States Congress, and I dare say more so outside of the Beltway, where people, all recent polls indicating that they get it, they understand, they're hearing the warnings that the scientists have been making for all these years. Now let's develop a plan of specific action that we can take. And let's coalesce together in cooperation, because there are many benefits, and there's great opportunity that exists out there for us to turn this all around. And if there's one thing we want to do on behalf of our children, if we all believe that we are stewards of this environment, is to make sure that we're taking the right steps to repair the damage that has been done, that caused by humans, inadvertently or not.
Congressman John Larson is the first district congressman. He will be moderating a panel discussion tomorrow night at Hartford's Mark Twain House. The World Affairs Council is hosting Global Warming, a panel discussion. Congressman Larson, thanks so much for joining us here again on Where We Live.
Always a pleasure, John.
Also joining us by phone, thanks to Dr. Angie Seth, a research assistant professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Connecticut, who will be part of this panel discussion tomorrow evening. Dr. Seth, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Coming up on the program, we'll be talking with a Yale economist studying the impact of climate change on rich and poor countries around the world. We'll also continue our discussion with Chris James, manager of climate change and energy programs at the Department of Environmental Protection. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. We're talking climate change, where we live on WNPR.
In 1947, Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in baseball, becoming not only a sports hero, but a figure from history.
He was there to change society, and in time, he did.
But 60 years later, the percentage of African Americans who follow and play the game is dwindling. I'm Scott Simon, Blacks and Baseball, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Listen to Talk of the Nation weekday afternoons at 2 on WNPR and WNPR.org. Our funding comes from our members and from the Ethel Walker School in Simsbury, day and boarding for girls in grades 6 to 12, the only all-girls middle school in Greater Hartford. Walker students emerge through excellence in academics, arts, and athletics. EthelWalker.org. The Ethel Walker School is not for profit. And from People's Financial Advisors, helping you see a wider view of your investment portfolio. Working with you to create new opportunities for your investments. See your portfolio through the eyes of a People's Financial Advisor. 800-392-3009. Partly cloudy today with highs in the mid-40s. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 20s. Tuesday, partly cloudy with a high near 47. Tuesday night, partly cloudy, then gradually becoming clear with a low around 27. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut Public Radio, and WNPR.org.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about global climate change. A couple major studies coming out recently and some major news last week. Not only a UN study about global climate change, but also the U.S. Supreme Court saying that CO2 or carbon dioxide, a major greenhouse gas, can be listed as a pollutant. Coming up in a bit, we're going to be talking with a Wesleyan scientist calculating how much carbon dioxide levels are raising temperatures around the globe. My guest in studio, Chris James, he's the manager of climate change and energy programs at the Department of Environmental Protection. Joining us now over the line from Yale University studios is Rob Mendelson. He's an economics professor at Yale. He's done studies on the impact of climate change on both rich and poor countries. Somewhat not surprisingly, that the people most at risk for climate change live in the countries that have contributed the very least to the atmospheric buildup of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases. Rob Mendelson, welcome to Where We Live.
It's delightful to be here.
Tell us a little bit more about the studies that you've done and what you believe the impacts of global climate change have already been and what they will continue to be in the future.
Well, the climate hasn't actually changed a great deal already, so it's actually very difficult to see the effects of climate change currently. There are so many other things that are going on in the background. This is economic development and just changes in population, that the effects of the existing climate change has probably not been visible. But when we look into the future and we look at the kinds of climate change scientists are predicting, I think there'll be a very distinct climate message in that future events. So the kinds of things we've been looking at in this study was to look at actual scenarios that climate scientists had predicted for the future. And they talked about the possibility of some mild scenarios and the possibility of some very harsh scenarios, where harsh is very large changes in temperature. And so what we looked at is what would happen to individual countries around the world if these particular scenarios actually occurred. And the basic take-home message that we did find from this is that if in fact there's very severe temperature increases, the countries closest to the low latitudes, to the equator, those are the countries that actually would suffer the greatest damages. And the countries that were actually near the high latitudes, and including the United States, would actually only suffer very small damages. And the reason for that is that we found that the relationship between temperature and sort of aggregate impacts was related to kind of a hill-shaped function. And the United States is a little bit on the left-hand side of that hill, so any kind of increase in temperature keeps you on the top of the hill. But when you go to the low-latitude countries, you're actually on the right-hand side of this hill, And any kind of increase in temperature will actually knock you off the hill, and they will actually suffer very large damages.
So, of course, the first question that comes to my mind is, looking at this from a strictly economic standpoint, if that is indeed the case, then what's the incentive for the powerful countries of the world, which may not be affected as much, those in Europe and in North America, to do anything about this? If indeed developing countries are going to be the ones hit hardest, how do you push other countries, the ones who hold most of the world's power, to do anything to stop the emissions and also try to reverse the trends?
Well, I guess I would appeal to people's sense of responsibility. If you actually do an action that ends up hurting other people, that you should feel responsible for it. So even if it turns out it's not that harmful to us personally, it's going to be harmful to other people, and it's our actions that are causing it. So we should be responsible to the world.
Obviously, it's just one of the questions that comes up. Of course, when you look at how countries make decisions, quite honestly, they often don't make decisions based on those altruistic ideas. And some of the things that you're saying really do tend to fly against some of the other reports that have come out that say there will be major impacts in North America. There will be major impacts in Europe, if maybe down the road a little bit. Have you talked with people about some of the disparities in the modeling that you've used here versus others?
Well, it's true in the most severe scenarios, when you start talking about changes of 4 and 5 degrees, that you might start seeing downward effects even in the United States. But those are only the one piece of the possible things that might happen, and those will probably happen closer to 2100. They're not likely to happen anytime in the next 50 to 80 years.
One of the interesting things in this UN study that came out last week is that certain places in the world, given rises in temperature, depending on where the temperature rises to, could see increased food production, for instance. There are maybe not good outcomes, good in quotations, but there are outcomes that maybe people aren't thinking about, including increased food production in places that maybe don't have as much food as they should right now.
Well, agriculture is the place where you're going to see the largest impacts on the economy. And what we're expecting is that unless there's a mild scenario, most of the low latitudes, the places where that depend very much on local agriculture, that they will probably have a reduction in their output. So we're expecting poor countries in the low latitudes that are very dependent on agriculture, they probably will be negatively affected. So that will be a potentially very large harmful effect. But if you look at total aggregate production, we're expecting that there's going to be such a large increase in the mid to high latitudes in production there that total production of food probably will increase with most scenarios.
Some of the most widely publicized studies coming out about global warming, specifically from economists, have to do with risks and the risks of whether or not certain scenarios are going to happen, the risks of taking action now versus not taking action now. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that. People not only from Yale University but from other universities around the state have been looking at this idea of what risks there are to the various scenarios playing out in global climate change.
Well, as you well know, there's enormous uncertainty about what the impacts of climate change will be. If you look at the range of climate scenarios, they range from basically being very beneficial to being this harshly harmful. And we are not going to really know how harmful things are until way into the future. So the question is what do you do today because of that? And this is where the question of risks comes. And some people are advocating that we do very dramatic things today. Other people are saying, well, let's do some things today, but let's be prepared to do dramatic things in the future. So there are two attitudes about how to deal with this risk.
Let me quickly go to Chris James from the Department of Environmental Protection, from the Climate Change and Energy Program at the DEP, and talk a little bit about what states are doing to look forward at these risks. We were talking earlier with Congressman Larson about states have these specific plans, and all the states are working independently. Some are working together on various plans. I'm wondering if there's some way in which the states can all come together under one heading, or if there's some fear in your mind to that, because places like Connecticut have done so much already to reduce the impact of global climate change.
Yeah, John, I think this is actually a nice segue from the previous section, and that is that the states have really looked at this adopting what I call the precautionary principle, which is when you buy a house, you're required to buy flood insurance because there's a 1% chance that you might have a flood. Ditto, we went to war because there was a chance that there was weapons of mass destruction. The same principle applies to this issue of global warming. In fact, we have much more certainty of global warming than you getting floods, for instance, especially with the UN report indicating it's very highly likely. So what the states have done is to really something we've done for 30 and 40 years, which is based on the science, what are the appropriate actions that we should be taking now to achieve a desired degree of beneficial environmental future. And that has been a variety of different actions depending upon the state. New England has a long history of cooperating together on air quality issues. That cooperation helped us quite a bit when we put together the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which basically addresses emissions from power plants in New England and the Mid-Atlantic region. You have a similar effort now in the West Coast, where California is working with Oregon, Washington, and now Arizona and New Mexico on a similar type of program. And then on a much more broad scale effort, there are 35 states now that are part of what's known as a multi-state registry, which is a very basic step of inventorying what your emissions are and then having the ability to register what those greenhouse gas reductions will be at a specific plant. And having a consistent framework across the United States for that is an incredibly important step. And that's something we hope would be the framework of any national system, that the protocols used to measure the emissions, analyze them, report, et cetera, are the same so that whether your carbon emission occurs in Connecticut or California, and then assuming we have a national program in another country, a ton is a ton is a ton. And that's, I think, a core element going forward of any program that we want to not only assure is part of a congressional bill, but we also want to make sure that the state's efforts heretofore are recognized.
And you fear at all, perhaps, that the federal government could take actions that might, roll back some of the state's efforts already?
Well, there's some real discussion, and some of the folks that we've talked to are not sure how quite to do this. We're going to have to obviously work with them in terms of not preempting states' rights going forward. You may know one of the Clean Air Act and the Supreme Court case showed that where California has the right to have their own car standards. And as long as states adopt either the California standards or the federal standards, that's perfectly acceptable. What we don't want is for that type of right to be taken away in any sort of future carbon program, because states in general have been shown to be more nimble and proactive on these issues than the federal government. And that goes back even to 1970. It's not this particular time frame. It's really been a concern that's been embodied in that legislation from its beginning.
So I have to say that it's because the federal government is doing so little in this topic, it's been great that the states have actually got started. But in the long run, you want the states to coordinate in a single package where the marginal cost of abatement is set equal across all the states, so that we don't have some states making gigantic programs and other states doing very little. So ultimately, we'd like to have the federal government institute uniform programs. But for the time being, having each state sort of experiment with different programs is very educational, because it's giving us a sense of what kind of programs actually work and which programs don't work very well at all.
If you have a question about global climate change, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266, or you can email us where we live at WNPR.org. My guests are economics professor at Yale, Rob Mendelson, and Chris James, the manager of climate change and energy programs at the Department of Environmental Protection. Joining us now by phone is Professor Dana Royer. He's an assistant professor of earth and environmental sciences at Wesleyan University. He and colleagues have used nearly 500 data points to create the most comprehensive model of the relationship between CO2 and temperature to date. The findings indicate that over the last 420 million years, increases in CO2, that's carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, have had direct and calculable relationship to increases in global surface temperatures. Professor Royer, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you, John, for the invitation.
I'd like to ask you to maybe give us a little bit more in-depth on this study and this model that you've used to tell us a bit more about how carbon dioxide directly has already raised temperatures around the globe and how you might use this going forward.
Sure. Well, first, I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors on this study, Robert Berner and Jeffrey Park from Yale University. And so what we set out to do is to quantify the relationship between CO2 and temperature based on a 420-million-year-long record of climate change. And we did this in the following way. There are actually a number of ways that you can reconstruct levels of CO2 in these deep time archives. There are five or six well-accepted methods for doing this. We don't have any way to directly measure CO2, you know, 50 million years ago, but we can rely on what are called proxies. That is, there are a number of natural properties that correlate with CO2, and some of these properties we can actually measure in the geologic archives. And so if we can calibrate what those relationships may be, we can then measure those properties in the ancient record in order to back calculate out or reconstruct ancient levels of CO2. And so that's how we compiled those 500 or so data points for CO2. Now, of course, then the next question is, how do you correlate that to temperature? And that's actually a much trickier question. What we're most interested in is calculating the global mean surface temperature, which is actually quite difficult. It's even somewhat difficult to do that for the present day. And so we, if you will, sort of cut that Gordian knot. We basically circumvented that whole thorny issue by avoiding trying to generate a independent record of temperature. What we instead did was to rely on a geochemical model for calculating CO2. And this model is based on sort of first-order principles that relies on what are the major factors that can influence CO2 over these very long timescales. And if we can quantify how those processes have changed through time, we can then quantify how CO2 has changed over time. So it's completely independent from those proxy methods. And it turns out that one of the factors that's very important in these types of geochemical models is the relationship between CO2 and temperature. And so what we could do was to run this model many thousands of times for different levels of or different magnitudes of what that relationship between CO2 and temperature may be. And then based on the output, based on those CO2 calculations, we could then compare it directly to our proxy record of CO2 and to find out what run of that model best fit the proxy record. And what we found was that the best fit connection there was when we ran the model when the relationship between CO2 and temperature, which climate scientists often refer to as climate sensitivity, that is, for every doubling of CO2, by how much should we expect, how much warming should we expect? And we found that our best solution was a warming of 2.8 degrees centigrade.
So, and we're going to have to take a quick break. I'd like to ask you a bit more about that. How these calculations might play out then moving forward. If you'd like to join our conversation with Professor Dana Royer from Wesleyan University, Rob Mendelson from Yale University, and Chris James from the Department of Environmental Protection, call us at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. If you have questions about global climate change, that's the topic Where We Live here on WNPR.
On the next Fresh Air, writer-director Mike White. His films include Nacho Libre, The School of Rock, Orange County, and Chuck and Buck. His new film, Year of the Dog, stars Molly Shannon and Peter Sarsgaard. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Listen to Fresh Air weekdays at noon and again at 10 p.m. on WNPR and WNPR.org. Funding for WNPR comes from our members and from Eastern Connecticut State University, preparing tomorrow's leaders with a wide range of undergraduate majors. Eastern, Connecticut's public liberal arts university. Online at easterncc.edu. Log on to WNPR.org to listen to today's show or download the podcast. Do you want a CD of a past show? Or do you have questions or comments? Let us know. Send an email to wherewelive@wnpr.org. Partly cloudy today with highs in the mid-40s. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 20s. Tuesday, partly cloudy with a high near 47. Tuesday night, partly cloudy, then becoming clear, with a low around 27. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut Public Radio, and WNPR.org.
We're talking about global climate change, some of the science behind it, and some of the possible solutions here on the program today. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky, 860-275-7266 if you want to join our conversation. My guests in studio, Chris James from the Department of Environmental Protection, Climate Change and Energy Programs, Rob Mendelson, an economics professor at Yale University who's studied the impact of climate change on both rich and poor countries, and Professor Dana Royer, assistant professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Wesleyan University. We have a question from Jason, who's calling from Bristol. Jason, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm an environmental engineer here in Connecticut. I support strict air pollution control and whatnot. I have a question on the theory itself, which I can't seem to make sense of, which I understand the theory is that CO2 obviously drives temperature change. If you look at that ice core data that I think it was the Wesleyan professor just mentioned, you'll see that temperature actually goes up, or worse, it will go down for hundreds of years without any change in carbon dioxide levels. And then actually CO2 will follow the temperature change. So it's actually the exact opposite of this theory. So if we know that carbon dioxide is not causing these past temperature changes, including most recently the medieval warming period and the Little Ice Age, could someone there please explain why the global warming theory continues to be put forth despite not being supported by the science?
Let's go to Dana Royer, who studies carbon dioxide first. Go ahead, Dana Royer.
Sure, thanks. Well, the caller actually brings a very common question that we hear quite a lot, and not to be too curt, but it's a bit of a non-starter question for the following reason. You know, it's not good to think about the Earth system as a series of single causal relationships. That is, if you change one factor, then another parameter will change, and then that's it. You should really think of the Earth system as like a cobweb, a series of interlinked systems. So if you affect one of those nodes, if you affect one part of that web, you're going to affect the whole rest of the web. So it is true that in the ice core record, so looking over the last several hundred thousand years, in some cases, changes in temperature will lead changes in CO2 on the order of maybe a century or two. But what the initial trigger is not necessarily the most important point. It depends on what question you're trying to answer. But if we want to know, well, what's the long term, what is the eventual sort of equilibrium response to these various forcings, you have to move away from sort of single cause-effect relationships and think of the whole system, the whole Earth system as a whole. And what you find is no matter what the initial trigger may be, eventually with this sort of equilibrium response, you're going to see this coherent response where even the ice core's records show this. When you have changes in temperature, you have changes in CO2. It doesn't necessarily happen the day that the temperature changes occur, but you do have changes that occur eventually. And so the work that I've been doing looking over much longer reaches of time, the last 420 million years, again, we're seeing, you know, we can't parse out what the initial leads and lags may be, but what we are calculating is the whole Earth system response, and we see a very consistent message with those data.
Jason, thank you very much for your phone call. Before we let Dr. Royer go here, we're going to go to one more phone call from Mike, who's on a cell phone, about carbon dioxide. Go ahead, Mike. You're on Where We Live. Hello, Mike.
Hi. I wanted to ask a question about the study about the CO2. I seem to have read some articles that indicate there is a body of study that says that CO2 possibly may be more of a result of global warming rather than a cause, and I wanted to know if they had considered that possibility when they were building their models.
Well, this question is quite similar to the last question we just had, and so you know, I'd have a similar type of answer to it. We're interested in the net effect, the Earth system response to these perturbations, and when you think about it, when you cast the question in that light, you see a very consistent, cohesive view emerges from that. And I think that's the most appropriate question. As we're thinking into the coming centuries, that's what we're most interested in, not what the initial trigger may or may not be.
So let's ask you before we let you go, Professor Dana Royer from Wesleyan University. Looking forward, some of the discussion we've had here is really based on that. Certainly the UN report was based on looking forward at what the outcomes could be. Using the models that you've used, what do you see as a potential future given what we know right now?
Right. So you know, our work obviously is one piece to a much larger body of evidence. Ours is distinct in that we're looking at a much longer sweep of time. But it is quite striking, I think, that best fit solution that we've come up with, which is 2.8 degrees warming for every doubling of CO2, is almost identical to what the best fit solutions are for quantifying climate sensitivity based on the present-day Earth and the near-present-day Earth, which is about 3 degrees centigrade. This was a summary that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released in February. These are the reports that some of the other speakers have been referring to, and they synthesized a very large body of literature for quantifying the relationship between CO2 and temperature based on present-day and near-present-day records, and their summary is that it's about 3-degree warming. So the deep deep Earth records are suggesting 2.8 degrees centigrade. The present-day record is suggesting a 3-degree warming. And so that really, to me, points to a robust feature of the Earth. This sort of minimum amount of climate sensitivity is almost a built-in feature of the Earth system. And so as we move forward into the near future, you have this whole 420 million years worth of records sort of adding weight to all of these other estimates of climate sensitivity, all suggesting about a 3-degree warming for every doubling of CO2.
Professor Dana Royer, Assistant Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Wesleyan University, thank you so much for joining us and spending some time here on Where We Live.
Sure, thank you.
I'm John Dankosky. We continue our discussion of global climate change with Chris James from the DEP, Climate Change and Energy Programs, and Rob Mendelson, an economics professor from Yale University. I think you might both be able to weigh in on this next question coming from Michael, who's calling from Ashford. Michael, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I'm on a cell phone, too, so it may not be a clear signal.
You sound great.
But my question relates to something from Economics 101, the tragedy of the commons, with the idea being that the members of the global community are incentivized to max out their use of a resource, so that China and India have great incentive to burn coal, and that's a several orders of magnitude greater than any reduction we Americans do in our emissions. Is that rational to think that, or is that just pessimism?
Let's go to Rob Mendelson.
Well, that's the basic problem with global warming, is that the benefits are global and the costs, if you do something about it, might be national. Or in the case of Connecticut, they might be state. The only way to get around that is to try to get cooperative solutions. And if we get cooperative solutions, the idea is that the United States won't do it alone. We will try to get other major energy producers also to join us into one large global effort.
I would just add also that the changes that we're seeing now as a result of the greenhouse gases are those that have been put there by the industrialized nations over the last 150 years. So it's countries like the United States, like Europe, that have gotten us to the situation where we are today. And that really, I think, behooves us to be responsible, to act, so that these other countries, as was mentioned, China wants to be like us, have an example to follow.
But China wants to be like us in more ways than one, and China is rapidly increasing the amount of its emissions output. I'm wondering at what point, Rob Mendelson, this becomes purely a, sort of a political question between countries like the European Union and the United States and emitters like China and India. When does it stop becoming something having to do with the environment or maybe even having to do with economics, but it's strictly just a political issue about countries being able to work together and listen to each other when it comes to making this change globally?
Well, this is a very good point, that global warming is just one of many issues that we're talking to China about. We're obviously worried about blowing each other to smithereens with nuclear bombs, and we're worried about trade and other important issues that are on the table. And the more things that we can keep on the table and keep talking, the more likely we can include global warming as one of the issues that we will actually deal with in the future.
When we talk about trade, I'm wondering about the impact of various types of ways in which the United States can put pressure on China, though. At a certain point, do we use our leverage having to do with, trade or international politics to be able to promote some sort of better environmental stewardship on the part of large developing nations? Or do you think that that's not something that's likely to come down the road anytime soon?
Well, I think one of the things that we definitely need to consider is whether we can encourage developing countries to take a higher road, perhaps than is in their own self-interest. For example, one definite thing that we could consider is the idea that perhaps we could pay some compensation, especially to poor countries, maybe not so much China, who's rapidly developing and getting wealthier, but other countries such as in Africa and Southeast Asia that are much poorer. The idea that we might, in fact, pay some compensation to try to help them both do mitigation and also to help them with adaptation as climate actually does change and they suffer great damages.
What are some of the potential outcomes if the United States doesn't step forward and do some of the things that you suggest? What do you see as some of the models that could come down the road in developing nations when the global climate change that you say is overwhelmingly put forward by U.S. and European countries, if it's not mitigated and the impacts do happen in Central America, in Africa, in developing places, what do you see as some of the outcomes?
Well, what you'll see is the poorest of the poor, the rural poor, will be the most hardest hit. They're the people that are currently living in subsistence living. They may find themselves unable to stay alive in the places they actually live in at the moment. They'll have to migrate. You'll see widespread hardship, basically, to a select group of people that are the least able to deal with it.
Well, one last question for you, Rob Mendelson. How much of this is linked, do you believe, to the rise in population in not only in developing countries but in developed countries around the world? It's something that seems to be skirted around as a cause of global warming, and I'm wondering how much that's looked into from the economic standpoint. The well, rapid rise in population in many places.
Well, clearly, the problem is we're emitting too much CO2, and that's tied to energy, and the energy is tied to both economic growth and population growth. I think at the moment, if you look at the past 150 years, we're more responsible in the countries that have very slow growth are more responsible for the emissions than the countries' very rapid growth. Africa, for example, as an entire continent, doesn't actually have that great emissions, even though they've had a very large increase in population. So I tend to think that you have to be cautious about blaming population growth alone and not also including economic growth as an important explanatory factor.
Rob Mendelson is an economics professor at Yale University who's studied extensively the impact of climate change both in the developed world and in the developing world. Thank you so much for lending some of your insight to our program today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. And as we close out the program, I'm joined again by Chris James, the manager of climate change and energy programs at the Department of Environmental Protection. Some of the things that we've gotten questions about certainly have to do with things like carbon taxes. How much of a burden, for instance, should companies have to take on in order to lessen greenhouse gas and other emissions that are causing global climate change?
Well, I think you're already seeing companies taking these steps today. I would just mention UTC as a Connecticut company is one example. They have doubled their revenue in the past 10 years, and their energy use has been flat. So that's a very powerful message. Other companies are very similar. Many of them are located overseas, so they have multinational responsibilities. But you see companies ranging from DuPont to Timberland to Patagonia that have reduced their carbon footprint for a variety of reasons. With respect to carbon tax, unfortunately, I think in this country, the idea of a direct tax on folks is not a starting place, even though I agree with people like Jim Rogers from Duke who espouses this type of thing. We haven't seemed to have accepted that as either citizens or as a government, that we should tax ourselves more because of our impact. So where does that go? Well, through the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, for example, we are for the first time going to charge people for the allowances that we're providing. Under the acid rain program and reducing smog, all those permits to pollute were given away for free. We have now decided, as a result of this nine-state effort, we really ought to be trying to link the actions back to you know, some consumer benefit. So the proposal is that at least 25% of those allowances will be auctioned just like any other commodity, and then the revenue will be directed towards energy efficiency, renewable energy programs that can directly not only reduce the carbon footprint but also reduce energy bills and also promote economic development.
And you think consumer incentives is what's going to get it done?
Well, it's been helpful. I think we would certainly favor, if there was a national tax, that'd be great. I just don't see the stomach for it right now.
Chris James is manager of climate change and energy programs at the Department of Environmental Protection. He's part of a panel discussion that's happening tomorrow evening at 6:30 p.m. at Hartford's Mark Twain House. It's hosted by the World Affairs Council. It's called Global Warming, a panel discussion. Also on the panel, Dr. Angie Seth, who joined us earlier from the University of Connecticut. The moderator will be Congressman John Larson, the 1st District Congressman. Chris James, thank you so much for joining us here on Where We Live.
Well, you're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
We also got an email from Beth Byron, who says that coming up on Saturday, April 14th, Hartford County residents concerned about global warming are rallying at Bushnell Park. It's part of the Step It Up 2007 campaign. That's all the time we have for Where We Live today. Where We Live, produced by Katie Talarski, George Goodrich, Diane Orson, Melissa Blankstein. Coming up next is On Point. I'm John Dinkoski. Thanks for joining us.